Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
My first Sunday back with you all. It's been good to be back and excited to start off a new year. The new series, though, is called 2020, looking at hindsight, insight, and foresight. And the reason for that is because the way you understand and see time impacts how you see and understand your life. And when you don't understand time in its proper context, it can really mess you up. In other words, you need to understand what is your past and what is your present and what is your future. You need to be able to understand what is just a temporary thing in your life and what is something that is permanent or eternal or is lasting. What is a work in progress and what is a finished product? And when you get those kind of things confused when it comes to how you see the time in your life, it leads to major problems. And so we're going to start off our year looking at that. And to do that, the first of that is hindsight, which worked out perfect because every year I like to start off by looking back over the previous year, kind of with hindsight and saying, where did we come this year? What did we learn this past year? Jesus, as he ends his most famous sermon in the Bible, it's recorded for us, his Sermon on the Mount, he ends it with this parable where he basically sums it up and says, if you hear these words of mine and put them into practice, then your life will be like one that's built on a rock. So it's not just the hearing that matters, it's the hearing and the doing. In other words, he's trying to say application makes all the difference. In other words, it doesn't matter if you were here at all this past year or not, your life's going to be no different unless you apply what we heard and saw this past year. And so we kind of, before we move forward, I want to look back. I always say this is the best sermon or the best Sunday of the year to be here because you can literally miss an entire year and get everything crammed into one. It's also a way because the average person attends church around 8 to 10 times per year. I know you all come every Sunday, but the average person out there will only go 8 to 10 times a year. So if that was you, that means you probably missed a few things over the course of the year. You might want to know, what do I need to go back and listen to? This gives you an idea what to go back to listen to. And also, of course, we sprinkle in there some of your favorite, we put all the bumper clips in there, but I put some of your favorite videos you saw over the past year. Maybe yours will make it, maybe it won't, I don't know. But we start off the year with the old you series. And so with that, let's go back.
Here I go, playing star again. There I go, turn the page.
I think that was my favorite song of any of the bumpers from this past year. You can't go wrong with a classic. This series, it began off the year talking about change. And I don't know if anybody picked up on this other than our team when we were planning this out. Every series of the entire year last year was all about change. You may have picked up on that or maybe not. Maybe this morning as I put it all together, you'll see how every single message was about change. Because everything in the gospel is about change. It's about who I was and who God is making me. It's I once was dead in my sins, but now I am found alive in him. I once was lost, but now I am found. The gospel is about change. And so we began off the whole, you know, the new year by saying, okay, let's look back over the old you and let's look at how change happens. And we said there's three elements of a change. Number one, you have to make a decision. If you don't make a decision, you cannot change. And second thing I'll say about that is if you didn't move, you didn't make a decision. A lot of people fool ourselves into thinking, oh, well, I made a decision. Well, if you haven't moved, you haven't decided. Okay, you've just fooled yourself into that. Something's pushed you to make a decision. It's pushed you to make a choice and to move. If you haven't actually moved, you didn't make a choice. You didn't make a decision. Well, I decided to clean my room. Well, your room's not clean, so it doesn't mean you really decided now, does it, right? You have that conversation. So you have to decide. The way change happens, one, you have to decide. There has to be a conviction within you that moves you to action. That is where you make a decision. Second thing about change is it happens from the inside. There's something at your core that changes. You change the way you see something. You change the way you think about something. You change what is important to you. You change what you see as your ultimate goal in life. There's something at its core has to change in the way you see something. You have to, in other words, you move from looking at marriage as God's purpose and primary instrument to make me more like him, from used to thinking that marriage was just to make me happy. If you want to go through life thinking marriage is going to make you happy, talk to somebody who's been married 10 years. Because at 10, they're still trying to make it happy. Once they get about 40 or 50, they realize that marriage made them more like Christ. And they found happiness along the way. See, it changes the way you see. You have to change the way you see it in order to make that change happen. You have to change what you see as important or as valuable to you to make that change happen. And then lastly, love is the ultimate motivator for change. You have to be captivated in a love for Jesus Christ. That's why we say this life is about nothing more than a loving relationship with Jesus Christ that you'll enjoy for all eternity. That's where all change begins with that. There are two ideas in life about how people see life. One is summarized in the poem Invictus, which ends with these words. Maybe you've heard this. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. That is one way to go through life. You're the master of your fate. You're the captain of your soul. Whatever you say goes. You make it up as you go. There's no outside entity. There is no creator. There's nobody you're accountable to. You are the ultimate authority in your life. That is one way to go through life. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17 says, that is a futile way of thinking. Futile means it is incapable of producing the desired result. It is futility. It is incapable of producing the desired result. If you want to go through life with the idea that you are the master of fate, you are the captain of your soul, what you're going to find is that when you have the things in life you want, a good marriage, maybe financial stability, whatever it may be, you're going to find that with that as your core, it's futile in your thinking. Rather, what needs to change is you need to come to a recognition that you are a created being. You were created by God. He has an intended purpose over your life. Therefore, he has an authority over your life. Ultimately, you will have to give an account for your life to him, which is why we say this life is about nothing more than that relationship. And if you don't see his life being about that relationship, any change you make in your life is temporary. Any change you make in your life will be temporary unless it's a change motivated by who's the ultimate authority in your life. Why? Because at the end of the day, I may want to do something for your sake, but ultimately I'm in control and I'm going to do what I want to do. So I'm going to revert back to what I've always been doing because let's face it, that's what I really wanted to do anyway. Any change made for any other reason is going to be temporary. However, when you change the core fundamental of who you are because of how you see life, change becomes permanent. And something I couldn't missed by when I went back over this. There's a great quote that I read to y'all back then. I said, question was once put to me like this. If the distance between the earth and the sun were just the thickness of a sheet of paper, so just take the distance to 92 million miles, let's just say that is one thickness of a sheet of paper, then the distance to the nearest star would be 70 feet high of those papers stacked up. That's just to the nearest star. The distance to the edge of our galaxy would be a stack of papers 310 miles high. And our galaxy is just one in over a billion galaxies in the known universe that can be seen. Hebrews chapter 1 says that God holds together this entire universe by the power of his word. And Isaiah tells us that he measures out the universe and says it's about this big with his hands. And if that is who God is, does that sound like somebody you want to have as your co-pilot? See, the bumper says God is my co-pilot, really? Is that somebody that'd say, why don't you just sit here in the jump seat here, buddy, and if I need you, I'll ask you for your advice. That's one way of going through life. The other way is to simply say, you're God, I'm not. You tell me where we got to go. You tell me what we want to do. You're in control of this whole process. And so the whole change process begins with an understanding of who God is and who I am in relation to him. After that, we went into the Love Works series.
Love is hard work, baby, that's a fact. Two steps forward and three steps back. Love is hard work now. Man, that's a fact.
In that series, we simply said, love works if you do. Love works if you do the work of love. 40 years ago, Dorothy Tennov wrote a book called Love and Limerence, The Experience of Being in Love. And she described the experience of falling in love as an involuntary, impersonal state that involves an acute longing for emotional reciprocation, obsessive-compulsive thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and emotional dependence on another person. We also, in there, she talks about how falling in love is referred to as infatuation, lovesickness, romantic love, even a love addiction, or attention deficit disorder. But what she does, Maybe you've seen some teenagers or yourself. And she goes into making an argument that we really shouldn't even call that love. We should. And so she makes up a word. She literally just invents a word called limerence. She says, let's just call that limerence, if you will. It's sort of this limbo sort of state, limerence. It's a state of euphoria that is sort of self-fulfillment driven. I love the way you make me feel. And it mimics all the characteristics of true love. In other words, it'll have you write notes, make elaborate date plans, make this person your highest priority, say loving things, do loving things. But at the end of the day, limerence is all fueled by this euphoric feeling. We get something out of it. And she points out that this euphoria is not sustainable. It typically lasts anywhere from 3 months to 3 years. And after that, it runs its course. And then you hear people say, I don't know, I just don't love them anymore. I'm just not in love with them anymore. And that usually is the number one excuse for why to walk out of a permanent relationship. Well, I just don't love them anymore, so I think it's time to move on. But we talked about how we don't use that logic anywhere else in life and get away with it, right? I don't feel like going to work, so I'm not going to go to work. Now, maybe some of the people you've worked with do that, but it doesn't work very long. You know, I don't feel like obeying the rules, so I'm not. Well, you see, Your Honor, I didn't feel like the speed limit applied to me, so therefore you would fully understand I didn't have to obey it. You would never make that argument in the court of law, yet we'll go into a marriage counseling office and say, well, I just don't feel like I need to stay in a relationship because I don't feel like I'm in love anymore. The reality, Dorothy would argue, is perhaps you were never in love. Perhaps you were in limerence. Because limerence is a feeling. It is an instinct. It is a reaction, whereas love is a choice. Love is a choice. Love takes work. Love is something you do. And that's why what worked at the beginning doesn't work anymore, because love, well, real love works. That's a promise we see from Scripture. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 says love never fails. Never fails to what? Never fails to work. It never fails to work. It always works. It always starts on time, runs on time. It does exactly what you would need it to do. And it'll change the way you see people. It'll change the way you see your life. It'll change the way you see your marriage. It'll change the way you love people. It changes how you love yourself. It changes the way you see your attitudes. It will change everything about you. Love works if you do the work. But love takes work. So love works if you do the work of love. One of the final thoughts from that thing is sometimes I just see great quotes, and I can't give you the full context, but it just says, the grass is greener where you water it and where you protect it. Right? You know, stuff doesn't just grow in the garden because you want it to grow. It takes work. It takes a lot of work to grow those vegetables, which some of you all love. After that, we went into the Spark Joy series with one of my favorite videos from the year.
Last year, you guys were riding me really hard for the website, and I just peeled out my Z3 and I knocked the mirror off somebody's car. I never said a thing.
Wait, what? You knocked the mirror off of my car?
Yeah. Isn't that messed up?
Yeah.
That guy did a lot of things I'm not proud of.
Wait, when you say that guy, do you mean you?
I mean the guy I used to be. I'm Ryan 2.0. And if it makes you feel any better, that guy did a lot of messed up stuff to me too.
No, you mean that you did a lot of messed up stuff to you.
Look, I feel you.
Too.
Okay? That guy took no responsibility for his actions.
But are you gonna pay for my mirror?
If I have to answer for everything that guy did, I'm never gonna move on.
It was like $200.
We're never gonna get what we need from that guy. Hey, anybody see a pair of sunglasses?
I think I saw some in the kitchen. Responsibility for what he did.
You're making room. In the KonMari method, what we primarily focus on is what sparks joy. But the objects in your house are not what sparks joy. Only Jesus can do that. Do you have room for him? If not, maybe it's time to tidy up.
Still not sure what she said in Japanese, but it might have been that. I don't know. That was a series we did during Lent this past year. Lent is something that the church has celebrated and observed for centuries in the 40 days leading up to Easter. And Lent was all about a season of sort of examining what is in your life and clearing out the clutter, which of course is what Marie Kondo, is that her name, Marie Kondo, always all about. Just clear out the clutter to make room for what sparks joy. And if you're going to make room for Jesus in your life to spark joy and to move you to a new place, first thing you need to do is clear out the clutter. And so we did a series, Spark Joy, about clearing out the clutter, which is where Ryan comes in. Ryan has an issue that all of us have, and that is that we don't want to acknowledge our own sin. We want to call it something like a mistake. Because we don't want to call it sin. Because, you know, it's just, we want to sort of like take away any sense of responsibility or ownership of what happened and just move on like it never, ever happened and not deal with it. We just sweep it under the rug. And I think if you were to ask Miss Marie, hey, is it okay if we just take stuff and sweep it under the rug? She would say, no, you need to get it out. You need to get it out of the house. And what they would do once you get up to Easter during the Passover season, they would literally clear the house of anything with leaven in it. In other words, they would clear the house of anything. Leaven would be where you take a piece of the old dough and you save it and it would ferment and that would give rise to the new dough. Basically it's saying take away all this stuff from the past and get it out. You need to go through your house and clear it out. We need to do a house cleaning. The thing about sin is until you acknowledge the sin in your life, nothing's ever going to change. If you're just going to gloss over all your faults and failures, nothing is ever going to change. Until Ryan acknowledges that he is Ryan, there is no 1.0, 2.0, it's all you. You have a debt that you need to pay. Until you acknowledge that, nothing's ever going to change. And the thing about sin is, sin both explains our condition, why we are the way we are, but it also deceives us. It hides itself from us, explains why we're in the situation we're in, but we don't acknowledge it, it deceives us. When Adam and Eve sin, God comes in and he asks them three very profound questions. First question, he says, where are you? Where are you? And then he asks them the question, who told you you were naked? And then he asks them, have you eaten from the tree I commanded you not to eat from? Where are you? Who told you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I told you not to eat from? And which points to the fact that redemption begins when we're honest about where we're at, who we are, and why we're there. Those are his three questions. Where are you at? Who are you? And why are you there? Until you can really come to grips with the answer to those questions, change isn't going to happen. Because as long as you don't know who you really are, that I really am a sinful person. I really have issues. I really have some faults, failures, some hurts, some habits, some hang-ups. Until I'm willing to acknowledge that, change isn't going to happen. Where am I? Where has all those decisions brought me right now? A lot of us think we're in a much better place than we really are. Because we just don't want to acknowledge that we're really Ryan 1.0 and there really is no 2.0 yet. We're in a really bad place and we don't want to acknowledge it. We don't want to admit that we have some issues. And then lastly, how did we get there? What was it that led us to that place? What have you done that got you to that place? And so until you can acknowledge that stuff, you won't even know what to clean in the house. You won't even know what to go through. After the Spark Joy series, we moved into a modern family series with another one of the favorite videos of the year. Moms, this one is for you.
The day you were born was the best day of my life.
What was it like?
The day you were born, it was amazing.
Were you scared, Mommy?
Oh, no. I was excited. I had a big smile on my face the whole time. Didn't I?
Oh, yeah.
Mommy, were you scared?
Why does it look like that?
No, but daddies don't get scared.
I'm not ready!
You're not a man!
Then one little push, and you were born. And you were the most beautiful baby in the whole world.
Why does he look like that? Why is he yellow? Is that normal?
Why is he so ugly?
That's what happened on the best day of my life.
And you know what else?
Every day since then has been better than the day before.
Babe, where's my hockey stuff?
It's in the hall closet.
He woke up, by the way.
Can I get a drink after?
I love you, Mommy.
Oh, I love you too, honey.
Mommy?
Yeah?
I had an accident last night.
Oh, well, I'm sure Daddy cleaned it up.
No, I wanted you to clean it.
Go Berserk.
Series is all about what we need from each other within the context of a family. The primary thing that parents need from their children is honor, and the primary thing that children need from their parents is a blessing. And so we talked a little bit about honor, that honor's not a major part of our culture. We're a justice culture. There are many cultures around the world that are honor cultures, but we are a justice culture. In other words, you get what you deserve, which is why in America we're more about respect than we are honor. We sing songs about respect. We'll tell you how to spell respect. We'll get in fights over respect. I won't respect you unless you respect me is kind of our motto in America. It's all about respect. We're not going to give it until we feel like you deserve it or it's been earned. However, honor is very different. Honor simply means to place a greater weight on. In other words, you have the scales and you place a greater weight or value on this person. To dishonor somebody isn't necessarily to treat them poorly. It's simply to treat them as common, to treat them like just anybody else, to like they're just a regular person. There's nothing special about them. And what parents need from their children is to recognize, I'm somebody special in your life. Don't treat me like some hired hand. Don't treat me like anybody else. I often say to my kids, I'm not one of the kids at the lunch table. Like when they're at home and we're around the dinner table, hey, let me put a hand on that. Excuse me? This isn't the school lunch table. I'm your father. There's a different exchange that needs to happen here. And what you see in Scripture is that honor is something that we have to teach. If you look at the Ten Commandments, all Ten Commandments are about fundamentally about honor, honoring God, honoring yourself enough to take a day off for yourself, honoring your parents, honor your mother and father. It's right there. And then how we honor others in the context of society. And so we talked in there about how if God is saying honor your mother and father, do you think he's telling that to the kids or do you think he's telling to the parents that that's something they need to teach their kids? I mean, do you really think that your five-year-old is going to go, you know, Mom, Dad, I was reading the Scriptures the other day, and it occurred to me, as it says here in Exodus 20, I should show you honor. I never realized that before. Now that I do, I'm going to start. No, parents need to teach and instruct their children to honor. But what your kids desperately need from you is to be blessed. They need a blessing from you. Deep within the heart of every child is to know that their parents love them, care for them, honor them, adore them, value them. They're proud of us. They want the best for us. In the Old Testament, you see in this exchange between Isaac and his son, it was supposed to be Esau, but it turns out to be Jacob. Anyways, what you see in it is a whole other story. You can go back and listen to the message. There's five elements of a biblical blessing that you see there. One is meaningful touch. This is something that happens, should happen every day within the context of your family. Studies have now shown what happens when somebody is neglected any kind of physical contact. But, you know, that's why your kids, they need to be hugged and loved and patted on the back and high fives. Sometimes they need some cuddles, whatever it may be. Second of all, there's a spoken word of affirmation. Every child wants to hear, well done, I love you. Why do you think it is your child says, Dad, 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 watch, 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 here, look at this, what do they want? They just simply want to hear you say, great job, I love it. Then beyond that, to express a high value and acceptance. There's two times where God speaks to Jesus in the Scriptures audibly. One is at his baptism, the other is on the Mount of Transfiguration. And in both times he says, this is my son, whom I love, and in him I am well pleased. And it wasn't based on what he did, it's just based on his relationship with him. So one was before he'd done anything, and the other was before he'd gone to the cross. So he hadn't done the ultimate thing he was sent there to do, but God just puts his high value on him. Your children need to hear the same thing, that your love for them is not based on what they've done, that you just express a high worth and a value on them. Picturing a special future, help them and see and believe what God has in store for them, that you would paint out there for a preferred future for them. Sometimes it's hard for them to see it. They get distracted. They get discouraged. All they can see is their faults and their failures. And you need to share with them a vision over their life. You can share with them what God's vision for their life is, that God's got great things in store for you. You can do anything that you put your mind to. God has prepared you and gifted you with special things. And perhaps maybe that's not it. Maybe dunking a basketball is not your thing, and that's okay. That's not what God has specifically gifted you for. And if you try to make that your life goal, you're going to find you're struggling with that. However, there is something God has specially gifted you for. And when you find that, you're going to flourish, and you're going to flourish, and you're going to thrive, or you're going to thrush. That's thrive and flourish all in one. Thrush. And then lastly, an active commitment, willing to do everything possible to help them be successful. That's why you drive them to practice. That's why you get them up out of bed. That's why you give them the resources they need. That's why you stay up with them late to make sure they get it done or to help them with that project. That's why you buy them the tools and say, here you are. I want to make sure you have everything you need to be successful in this. I'm going to finance and fund the vision that God has over your life. That is how you bless somebody. That's how you bless your children. The primary thing that your children need from you isn't an Xbox. It's your blessing. Now, they won't tell you that, but honestly, that is what they need primarily from you is your blessing. And I told you that after Christmas, not before, for their benefit maybe as well. I don't know. After that, I moved into what I think was probably one of my two favorite series of the year, and that was In Transition.
It's much easier to come up with excuses and why you can't do it. If you do what is easy, your life will be hard. If you do what is easy, complain about your situation, your circumstances. Surrender and give up on your dreams. Become depressed and bitter and angry. Anybody can do that. If you do what is easy, your life will be hard. But if you do what is hard, keep coming back again and again and again. Get up dressed every day. Take life on. Taking life by the collar. You say, yes, I will do it. I can do this. And you've said to yourself, I'm willing to face the no's. I'm willing for people to laugh at me. I'm willing to gut this out. I'm willing to make this happen. It's my time. It's possible. It's necessary. It's hard. It's worth it. I'm going to do whatever it takes. I can do it. If anybody's ever done it at any point in time in history, then what's possible for one, it's possible for me, and I'm going to do it. And if you do that over and over and over again, your life will be easy.
It's been a long time coming, but I know change gon' come. Oh, yes it will.
So in keeping with the theme of change, we talked about transition, that change is situational, whereas transition is the psychological aspect of change. In other words, you may change jobs, but there has to be a psychological shift often when you go from labor to management. You may change your marital status, but there's a psychological change that has to happen when you go from single to married. You may go from living at home and going to high school to being in your first job or your first career, but you have to, please, for the love of God, for your employer's sake, move from being a child to being an adult. That is a psychological change that has to happen, millennials. All right, sorry, off the soapbox. Whew. Sometimes I just get carried away. But you have to let go of something you believed or assumed. You have to change the way that you see yourself or the way you've always seen yourself. Your outlook on the world has to become different in this. And in every transition has three phases. Ironically, the transition begins with an end. It takes you off a little bit. So it begins with an end, then there's this long middle period, and then there's sort of this fulfillment, this new beginning. And it parallels sort of death and burial and resurrection, if you will. And so the ending is all about the change. It's about the you're thrust into the change, or sometimes you plan the change. There are some changes you plan, like moving from fifth grade into middle school. That is a planned transition. You plan to get married. Some transitions are thrust upon you. You come to work, unbeknownst to you, and you're handed a pink slip. Somebody walks in and says, I don't want to be married anymore. You have no idea. Death can thrust you in. You go from being married to now being a widow. It just thrusts you into these transitions. And so you don't always get to choose when these changes come. which then moves you into the middle. And after sort of the shock of the change wears off, you move into this middle. The middle is a testing time. It is a growth time. It is where the psychological and transition has to happen. It's where you grow in this period. It's where you're pushed in this period. Throughout the Bible, you'll see these long middles. There's these 40 days of testings that happen, that the people wandered the wilderness for 40 years. They were tested and tried for 40 days. You'll see 40 is a standard time, whether it be for years or for days, of testings and of trials. That's why fasting would often be for 40 days. It's a symbolic time of testing, and it lasts a lot longer than you want it to. And the issue, the primary issue with this middle is trusting that God, when he says, I know the plans I have for you. You don't know. You don't know. But I know. I know the plans I have for you. And my plan is not to hurt you. My plan is not to harm you. You may be hurt in the process, but you will not be harmed. You get that? You may be hurt in the process, but you will not be harmed. My plan is not to harm you. My plan is to prosper you, to bring you someplace good. And I'm going to bring you someplace good. And I will do this. I know the plans I have for you, to bring you to good things, not to bad. And that's where you're ultimately going to get, but you got to trust me in the process. When you don't trust me in the process, you're going to quit. But you're not going to call it quit. It's going to look like one of two things. It's either go back or fast forward. They go back. That's where the people in the wilderness say, let's just go back to Egypt and be slaves again. Let's just go back to the dysfunctional mess I was in, because anything can be better than the unknown. We so fear the unknown, we often will go back to the dysfunction that God's thrust us out of. Or we want to fast forward the process. We want to jump circuit. That's why Luke doesn't want to stay with Yoda and do his training. Sorry. Some of y'all that connected, some of y'all didn't. We just want to fast forward the process. We just want to get on with it. I don't want to have to go to school. I just want to get out there and do it. But yeah, but you're not ready yet for it. I don't care. I just want to go do it. You can't rush the middle. You can't rush the transition. And once you get through the transitional period, you move into this wonderful, amazing place where God wants you, and that is the Promised Land. I highly encourage you, if you weren't here for that series, go back to that series. That's one of my favorite series I've ever done. Maybe it's just because it's been about my life. But I think it was a great series, if I just say so myself. Moving on that. From there, we went to some examples of people who made changes in their life and how they did it in our Real Character series. Four characters we looked at was Elijah and Esther and Abraham and Jesus. And Elijah and Elisha, his life was all about perseverance and persistence, that the change that you want to see in your life doesn't come overnight. It has to, it comes through perseverance and persistence, that every single day you get up and you're working at it, it's not going to happen overnight. With Esther, there was a paradigm shift. She went from thinking that being queen was all about her to maybe, just maybe, there's something bigger out there. Maybe God has put you in this position for such a time as this. Maybe the position you're in, the finances you have, the wealth you have, the access you have isn't just for you. Maybe it's also for somebody else. And so often when we're thrust into transition, we're like, how's this worry about me? How's this going to affect me? Maybe the transition's not about you. Maybe the transition's about somebody else bigger than you and yourself. You need to be able to make that adjustment in the way you see things to fulfill where God wants you to be. And then with Abraham, his life was a continual testing of his faith again and again and again. There was testing and testing and testing and testing and testing. Because once something is tested, it can be fully trusted. And maybe where God wants to lead you, you have to have the kind of trust in him to do it. And the thing that short-circuits so much of our change in life is temptation. We get tempted. And tempted is all about not seeing truth for what truth is. And so when Jesus is tempted in the wilderness, he comes back with the truth as it really is and says to Satan, no, that's not what's true. This is what's true. And if you lose sight of what is true, you're going to fall in your change process. After that, we went into our Celebrate Recovery anniversary series, which was Made New. Haven't been to Celebrate Recovery, you really are missing out. I always say everything we do in here is kind of like fake church. What they do at Celebrate Recovery is real church, and I have no qualms about saying that, because in here, you guys all look good. I mean, everybody's looking around, you're going, man, I wish I had their kind of life. You don't realize how jacked up they really are. At Celebrate Recovery, people just go, hey, my name's Steve, I lived a jacked up life, but I'm celebrating that Jesus Christ is authority and power of my life, and he can move me to change. something similar to that. I've been attending Celebrate Recovery for quite a while. At first, I just came to just observe, make sure Mike wasn't messing everything up, but now I'm just loving the service, and it's great. The crowd is growing. I can't say who was there. I can't say what happened there, because what I see there, what is said there, stays there. But if you want to know what goes on there, then you just got to go there, and that's on Wednesday nights. It's been really fun, exciting. After that, we went into the problem with our change, and that is fear. Fear, worry, and anxiety.
There isn't anything for you here.
No. This all belongs to me. This land, this forest, that stronghold of yours. Did you really think you could protect yourself from me in that?
It's not protection from you.
Then what is it?
An ark. To hold the innocent when the Creator sends his deluge to wipe out the wicked from this world.
The Creator does not care what happens in this world. Nobody has heard from him since he marked Cain. We are alone, orphan children, cursed to struggle by the sweat of our brow to survive. And if I don't do everything it takes to do just that, and if I don't take what I want, I have men at my back, and you stand alone and defy me. I'm not alone.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
In there, we talked about fear and worry and anxiety. Fear is a judgment call, bottom line. How does somebody have courage? They decide that what they're facing, or the reason why they're facing it, is more important than what they're going into. Why does somebody run into a burning building? Because they love that child more than they love themselves, and so they willingly risk their life and go in there to save that child. Fear is a judgment call. It's all about value. What is more important? And when you realize that there's something of greater value than yourself, you'll be able to act courageously, whatever it is. And when the transition's about more than just you and what you want, it's about your relationship with God or something beyond that or something more important, it'll motivate you to face your fears and to overcome them. And we talked about worry. Something specific may happen in the future. I talked about how it's a cognitive issue. Jesus answers the worries. He says, let's think about some stuff. You got to think this thing through. And God's hoping to move you from a what-if mentality to an even-if mentality. Once I trust that I am not alone and God is in control, I don't worry about the what-ifs. I kind of look at life as a even-if. Even if that happens, I know God is in control. Because life is about more than just my food and clothing, and worry doesn't solve anything, doesn't help anything, as we saw in Matthew chapter 6. And then lastly, anxiety. Anxiety is a dysfunctional pattern of thinking where we process information in such a way that we see things or believe things or trust in things that maybe aren't really there. And over 20% of Americans struggle with anxiety as a major issue. And there's an anxiety, I'll just kind of summarize it by basically saying this. Anxiety is a prompt to pray. You'll go back and listen to that message in a little more detail. Anxiety is your prompt to pray. What you have anxiety about is God's way of saying, this is something you need to be praying about. This is where you are really struggling with trust. This is where maybe you're not seeing things as they are. You need to pray here. And I'll end with this little disclaimer. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a lawyer. However, if you want, if you have an issue with psychology, go talk to them. But the series can help people who don't have a medical condition, but just have some issues with it. But go back and listen to the series, and you'll lead to where that needs to go. After that, I'm only going to show you part of the favorite bumper clip of the entire year. The Stuffed series.
And finally, monsieur, a wafer thin mint.
Bah.
Oh, sir, it's only a tiny little thin one.
Full.
Oh, sir. It's only a wafer thin.
Look, I couldn't eat another thing. I'm absolutely stuffed.
Just one.
Just one.
Just the one. Yeah.
Voila.
Bon appétit.
Enough. I love you, but enough is enough. Enough for that stuff.
That was all about how we live in a self-indulgent culture, which basically says just keep adding, and go whatever you want, add it all in. And the question comes up, when is enough is enough? And the reality is until God is enough for you, there never is enough. Your life will just be a black hole of need and need and need and need that nothing will ever satisfy until you realize that God is enough. And so once you realize how much is enough and when enough is enough, you won't know that unless you practice gratitude, realizing how much God has actually given you. You need the self-control to be able to follow through with that. You need self-control to make the wise decisions to do what you need to do. And then, of course, Pastor Chris ended out that series talking about how you need to add limits into that. You need to be able to cultivate that. You need to practice that. And so everything this past year was all about, was all about change. Yeah, I'm over time. It was all about how to change. And whether or not you made any changes all has to do with whether or not you applied the messages that you heard this past year, both from here at Essential and anywhere else that God has poured into your life.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.